That's Lee Morgan on trumpet leading off on Midtown Blues from his 1960 album Leeway. Jackie McLean on alto sax, Bobby Timmons on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Art Blakey on drums. They're all gone now, but together and separately, they made their marks before they left. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, April the 3rd, and two topics today. We'll be talking with an attorney who, for more than 30 years, has been representing clients who are among the most reviled people in the world. But first, an update on the dramatic turn of events in the bankruptcy proceedings in Detroit from our correspondent, Abayomi Ezekwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire and the Detroit organizer for the Workers' World Party. Thanks, Abayomi, for being with us today.
Yes. What are you doing?
Great. I'm all right. A lot of courtroom activity these past few days. So tell us where it starts.
I just returned from the federal bankruptcy court. It's on recess now until 2 o'clock. This is a hearing on yet another third agreement of the termination of the swaps. These are interest rate swaps that were signed in 2005 and renewed in 2009. They are contracts between the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and the United Bank of Switzerland, UBS. And the judge has struck down two previous agreements as negotiated by emergency manager Kevin Orr. And this is the third agreement to pay both Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and UBS $85 million to terminate these agreements. We've already, as taxpayers of the city of Detroit, paid these banks $300 million for essentially nothing. And in order to terminate these agreements, the emergency manager, who hasn't been elected by anybody, who was appointed by Republican Governor Rick Snyder, he's negotiated these agreements. And, of course, we were hearing arguments on both sides this morning. The Jones Day law firm under the emergency manager is ostensibly representing the city of Detroit, which is a complete contradiction. But that's what happens under dictatorships. And they say that this is the best deal. Now, they've said that about the other two deals as well. The first one was $280 million. The second one was $165 million. They were rejected both by the judge. And now they want to settle for $85 million. And we, of course, are objecting to that as well. The judge did say on January the 16th, when he struck down the previous proposal, that the city of Detroit had solid legal grounds for suing Bank of America and UBS for the damage done to the city as a result of these interest rate swap agreement from 2005 and 2009. They appeared, meaning the emergency manager and Kevin Orr, appeared to have just almost totally ignored that position, the ruling put forward by the judge, and went back and negotiated yet another deal, this time for $85 million. So the objectors cross-examined Kevin Orr and one of his experts, and I guess there'll be closing arguments at 2 o'clock when the hearing resumes. I don't know if the judge is going to issue a decision today. It may take a few days. But we're going to be anxiously awaiting his ruling.
Well, it started off with a bang on Monday. What happened on Monday?
Well, on Monday, there were efforts by the emergency manager to essentially tear up the existing pension boards. There are two major municipal pension boards. There's one for police and fire, and there's one general retirement agreement, general retirement fund. He wants to eliminate the board of trustees and to appoint his own people to these boards. So you can imagine the type of opposition that he's getting to that. The Retirement Association, they do have a a lawyer in a case who did cross-examine Kevin Orr in today's hearing. Then on Tuesday, we had a large demonstration outside the federal courthouse where retirees, workers, and community people organized and held a speak out. And they also have filed objections to this so-called plan of adjustment that's been put forward by Kevin Orr. This is over a 400-page document. There's part of it is the so-called disclosure statement, which they've amended at least once. And there's also this plan of adjustment, which calls for cuts in pensions and other draconian measures to be implemented as an exit plan for the whole bankruptcy process. So many people came out on Tuesday, and we filed over 100 objections just on Tuesday. There had already been 300 filed prior to Tuesday. Today, I saw another retiree who is an activist in the court, and she informed me that she had another 42 objections on her person that she was getting ready to file this afternoon. So we're looking at least now up to perhaps 500 objections, maybe even more, because they're coming in on a daily basis to this whole process. So it's unprecedented in terms of bankruptcy proceedings, and particularly as it relates to municipal bankruptcies. So more and more people are realizing that this is a life and death issue, that if they cut the pensioners' payments by a third, and the police and fire, initially they said by 6%, then they did some adjustments and brought it up to 10%. That's going to be devastating for those retirees, and it portends much for other municipal employees and retirees around the United States.
Well, it is kind of understandable considering this is a historic bankruptcy. It's the largest bankruptcy, municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. So it's not at all unusual that the response would also be historic. But it also suggests, I think, the work that has been done at the community level and within the unions to have invigorated opposition to this plan.
Yes, and as the Moratorium Now Coalition, we've put a lot of hours into this. We have weekly meetings where a large portion of our discussion is dealing with this bankruptcy and fighting this imposed economic crisis. And a lot of retirees are coming out to those meetings. They're taking ownership in this whole process. So it's really a tremendous contribution to the overall struggle. This case in Detroit is going to, of course, set a precedent for other potential attacks on municipalities across the United States, because according to Bloomberg, the financial publication, there are at least two dozen states around the U.S. That have what they call, quote, underfunded, unquote, pension systems. And, of course, Detroit, the state of Michigan, is like number 19 on that list. And Illinois is number one on that list. And people typically think about Chicago as being a vibrant and prosperous city, but they're considered to be the highest underfunded pension system in the United States. So we can see clearly what the agenda is. They want to eliminate the boards of trustees to these municipal pension funds, appoint these Wall Street hacks so they can get directly at the funds, and then they, of course, can take these pension funds and restructure them in a way in which they can siphon off even more money to Wall Street and even starve pensioners to the point of even death, because we can see clearly when you take a third of a pensioner's wages and eliminate their health care and force them, if they're over 65, into Medicare, if they're under 65, into the Affordable Care Act, which has a lot of problems. And I'm saying this from the left, not from the perspective of the right wing, But what we really need in the United States is national health insurance. Every centralized state has it. Every other progressive state around the world has it. In Cuba, they have national health insurance. They have the highest physician-patient ratio perhaps in the world. Here in the United States, which is supposed to be the richest country in the world, we still have tens of millions of people who have no health insurance. And even the ACA, from the reports that we've gotten from the retirees, they're going to have to pay anywhere between $500 to $1,000 a month for health coverage under the Affordable Care Act. So this is not a panacea for working people and for retirees at all.
Now, let's talk about some of the logistics here. Even though these, you know, the objections have been filed and so forth, the judge seems to still have a number of decisions just hanging. What's happening with those decisions?
There are a number of decisions. First of all, we talked about today in terms of what's going to be done to terminate these swap agreements. Also, there are other hearings that are taking place on issues involving health care, the termination of the health care benefits for the retirees, which took place on March the 1st. Then coming up in July, there's going to be a trial on the plan of adjustment, and that is the exit process from the bankruptcy. So there's going to be a lot of activity between now and July 16th. And on July 16th, we're making a call on behalf of the Moratorium Now Coalition and others in the city for people around the country to come for the first day of the trial, to come and demonstrate their solidarity with the city of Detroit. And we're going to put that call out this weekend at a conference that's taking place in Chicago, a labor conference. So we think that people around the country, and there has been a lot of solidarity expressed around the country and indeed internationally.
But you know, Abiyomi, the one major question still has not been resolved is the constitutionality of this whole process. What happened to that decision?
Well, that is pending in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. I don't know exactly when hearings are going to take place, but there are going to be hearings about the overall constitutionality of Public Act 436. They did agree that the appeal could go forward. However, they exempted the city of Detroit, which is already in bankruptcy. So any decision would only apply to cities outside in Michigan, outside the city of Detroit, which is was forced into bankruptcy last July by Governor Snyder and Kevin Orr in order to avert the mounds of litigation against what they were attempting to do in terms of restructuring the pensions, the healthcare systems, and other aspects of this forced bankruptcy. So, yes, those are issues, too, that also have to be resolved. And they could also have an impact on the bankruptcy proceeding as well.
Wow, this is such a mess. It really is an absolute mess.
It is.
And in the meantime, I mean, we don't hear very much from Washington on this.
Absolutely nothing. The Obama administration filed a brief saying that the entire emergency management process was constitutional. So, in effect, they are supporting the emergency management of Detroit and the filing of bankruptcy. And then on top of that, back in June, the Obama administration sent a delegation to Detroit saying that they were going to provide $300 million in federal grants to ostensibly help the city. But what came out of that meeting, and this was even reported in the corporate media, that there was no new money. The money already existed in the state. They were just withholding the money from the city of Detroit in order to create a crisis so they could have a rationale to justify the bankruptcy. They deliberately withheld grants from the city of Detroit that would help people in terms of social services, job training, and other issues that the city of Detroit had been carrying out. They eliminated the Department of Human Services completely, laid off all the employees, forced the ones who could into retirement, and turned over the administration of these grants to so-called nonprofit organizations, which are really private entities in their essence, to administer, that are outside the city of Detroit. Now, these grants did not cost the city of Detroit one penny. There was no reason to eliminate the employees who were administering these grants, and there was no reason to withhold the transfer of this money to benefit the people of the city of Detroit. So they did this deliberately in order to create a crisis, and also was paying the salaries of the city of Detroit employees, and they in turn were contributing to the pension system. So what their objective was, to not only create a crisis in the city, but also to further defund the pension system. And I want to mention as well quickly that this plan of adjustment does not call for any contributions to the Detroit pension systems for 10 years. So wow. 10 years, they're not going to contribute anything to the pensions. They claim they have a pledge from these so-called philanthropic organizations, which are the big foundations that are really chaired, and the board members are all bankers, executives, and multi-billion dollar lawyers who are on the advisory boards and the board of directors of these foundations. They're claiming, along with the state, that they could contribute $816 million to the pension funds, and also to a fund to preserve the Detroit Institute of Arts. But according to the formula that was used by Kevin Orr and the emergency management team, they're claiming that the pensions are underfunded by $3.5 billion. Now, there's been serious questioning of the formulas in which they use, and that came out today, this morning in the hearings. But if you compare $800 million to $3.5 billion, it still leaves a huge gap, and there's no guarantee that this money is going to be forthcoming. It's all contingent upon the retirees voting to accept this so-called plan of adjustment, which is really to vote in favor of cutting your own throat. So we've been advising, and we have a whole campaign. We have a banner telling the retirees and all creditors in the city of Detroit to vote no on this plan of adjustment, because it's totally unfair. Mm-hmm. And this is our position, and we're going to maintain that position. And they've been threatening the retirees, saying, well, if you don't accept this plan, then it could be worse. So you could accept this or else. And that's not the way to proceed in any type of negotiated process.
Well, thank you, Abayomi, for this update. It was an extraordinarily complex couple of days. But you managed to pull us through the understanding of it. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, you see, you have to remember that this is the template for a national strategy to force particular cities into bankruptcy, and then to take them over and to reorganize them to suit the new vision for America. We'll take this break, come back to our next guest in 30 seconds flat. It was a victory for prosecutors March the 26th when, after a three-week trial, a federal jury in Manhattan convicted Suleiman Abu Ghait, the son-in-law of Osama bin Laden, on three counts of terrorism. For Ghait's attorney, Stanley Cohen, it was a not surprising outcome. Cohen's legal career, spanning more than 30 years, has been fraught with controversy, but based, he says, on a simple maxim, and that is, quote, "I defend the individual against the state," unquote. His practice is global. His clients, an assortment of major players in high-stakes social, political, and environmental injustice struggles, and his reputation, well, let's just say he has a website with a page dedicated for haters. Stanley Cohen, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Therese. Pleasure to be along with you good folks today.
It has been a while since we talked, 500 years ago. In fact, that was a very controversial case. I'd let the audience know that you and Bill Kunstler, the late Bill Kunstler, represented Larry Davis.
That's true.
I keep telling folks that, you know, some people don't believe that he was actually employed by a ring of dirty cops in the Bronx to run a drug and prostitution and gun running operation up there.
Indeed, it was 1,000 years ago, and we fought the good fight, and there were a variety of different indictments. They came to kill him. They trapped him in an apartment room, or in a room in an apartment. It was a gun battle. He shot his way out. He shot 9 police officers, and a Bronx jury later found him not guilty of attempted murder and assault charges under a theory of self-defense.
And it was a stunning ruling. How do you end up 30 years of representing some of the most controversial people and organizations? I mean, we could go down the list. It just is inexhaustible, it seems. How do you end up with that?
Oh, you end up lucky. You end up born in a time where resistance was a good word, where silence was a bad word. You end up growing up in a family that was very supportive and very active and taught you at a very young age that you don't go silently into the night, and you stand up and you be counted among those that resist and fight back and speak on behalf of the little guy and gal, and along the way you get lucky. You meet great freedom fighters throughout the world. You befriend great political leaders, folks whose names you'd recognize and folks whose names you would not, and you begin to realize that there's nothing more important in the practice of criminal defense work, which I've committed my life to, than defending the person against the unbridled, sheer, and vicious power of the state. And that includes everyone from the guy accused of jumping a fare in New York City to the leader of Hamas or Hezbollah, or to Suleiman Abu Ghraib's son-in-law, or to the group Anonymous, or American Indian movements fighting back to protect their land and their future.
With respect to the recently concluded trial, you are filing an appeal, but did you expect the trial to go any other way than the way it did?
No, not really. Look, you know, I predicted during the opening statement that this jury was going to be inundated with appeals to irrelevant, incendiary information. Namely, this was not Osama bin Laden who was on trial. This was not a case involving 9/11. This was not a case in which there was any allegation, let alone proof, that Suleiman Abu Ghraib had anything to do with any of the terrorist acts connected to al-Qaeda. But yet the government would go out of its way to show the buildings on fire and to repeat the mantra of Osama bin Laden in 9/11 over and over and over again to substitute for the sheer and overwhelming absence of evidence in a hope of sweeping away a jury of New Yorkers in a sea of anger and pain and retaliation. They made those references in opening and closing remarks no less than some 240 times relevant to this case. They showed video after video related to 9/11, irrelevant to this case. And when it came down to evidence that he conspired to murder Americans, there was none. You combine that with a judge who saw this as the train leaving the station without justice and in a race to make sure that there was a unanimous verdict and very quickly, who ruled against us repeatedly, who denied us an opportunity to allow Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who the U.S. government claims to be the architect of 9/11 and most other terrorist acts attributed to Al-Qaeda, to testify on our behalf. He denied us an opportunity to explore the 11 years that Suleiman Abu Ghaith was detained without charge, unconvicted, in Iranian custody, even though the government had argued he was part of a continuing conspiracy. He sat jurors who should have never been seated because they clearly showed bias. He precluded areas of cross-examination that would have exposed the retaliatory nature of the government's case. This was not a judge who was going to permit a not guilty verdict in this case, in this city, in this time. And when the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, who has allowed his administration to become the most politicized administration in the history of this country, who's become responsible for enforcing the political agenda of Obama, in his post-conviction roundup went on to point out that it was fitting that this case was tried in the shadow of where the World Trade Centers had been. That sums it up. 9/11 had nothing to do with this case, but the government desperately hung on to it, pushed it, and sold it to make it impossible for jurors to be independent, and we expected it. But we expect to prevail on appeal. We expect to be back, and we expect to be vindicated.
Why did he specifically request you as his attorney?
Oh, I have represented some of the most adored and despised freedom fighters in the Middle East and in various parts of the world. I have a reputation, I believe, for fighting vigorously against the state. I've had an enormous practice representing Muslims throughout the world. My reputation speaks for itself. I put together a team of lawyers who are not going to be bullied or battered, who would fight the fight, who had access to places and people throughout the world that basically no one else did. We met, we talked, we liked each other, we agreed upon a strategy, and the family said we want Stanley Cohen.
You know, it's in this regard, Stanley, I want to ask you a question, because after a while, no matter how anesthetized you become about certain people, whether they like you or they don't like you, it really doesn't matter. But I want to ask this question in the cultural sense. You are Jewish, mm-hmm. and you come out of your family, if I understand it correctly, as of the Orthodox tradition. But you have done a lot of work, it seems, against the state of Israel. That you've represented in cases where most American Jews would have trouble saying, well, why is one of us on the side of the enemy? How do you cope with that?
Well, my dad, who was a very famous West Indian trade union activist, taught me at a very young age that we measure our success not by our friends, but by our leaders. This is not a beauty contest. This is for truth and justice. I'd like to think the Jews as a people have stood shoulder to shoulder for the millennium against the oppressed, just as we have received comfort and support over that period of time from many groups, including Muslims. I think the state of Israel is guilty of gross war crimes in this day and age. I think the state of Israel is built upon the backs and continues to function under genocide, apartheid, collective punishment, ethnic cleansing, occupation, and violation of international law. My view is that Jews don't challenge ourselves to live up to a tradition and to say no, then who is there left to do it? Every day, the state of Israel and Zionists carry out enormous crimes against Palestinians. 11 million stateless, largely homeless people who live in refugee camps throughout the world, whose only crime was to be born in a time and a place where the rest of the world conveniently allowed Israel to steal land, to take land, drive Palestinians who had lived in these lands for the millennium into foreign countries. And, I will not go silently into the night. I lost family in the Holocaust. I've been empowered by such movements as the White Rose in Germany. I've been empowered by the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto who fought back and lost their lives and they refused to assimilate to the night. And my view is that the penultimate war criminal in the world, say, in terms of state war crimes, is Israel. I fought on the side of Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians, political Islamists, Islamists and not, for over 20 years. I consider it a great honor and a privilege, and I will do so to my dying day. But Zionism is not equal to Judaism. Israel does not speak for the Jewish people of God.
We're getting a little crackle on your end. Are we okay with it? I have to ask the engineer. Are we all right? You were cracking up a little bit there, Stanley. Okay, you're fine, he says. So this is your work. This is your life's work, you see. Okay, if we'll try and get him back. There's a delinking going on, and we're getting a lot of interference. So we'll try that again and get him back. I'll just talk about some of the cases that he has represented in the past and continues to represent. At great cost, he's been threatened. He's had all kinds of crazy things happen to him in the course of just being a lawyer. And it's amazing that he continues. I was talking about this in the case of Israel. He's and other cases internationally in South Africa and in all around the world, really, particularly in the Arab world. He has been part of a team or has headed up a team of lawyers to defend many people who have been targeted by their governments, their respective governments, for prosecution for these kinds of crimes. And it has not been an easy thing, I imagine, to get him. Are we okay with him? Is he back? We're trying to figure out how to get him back here. He's not yet back. All right, let's take a music break, and we'll come right back and see if we could reconnect with Stanley. He's not at his office. Thanks.
Hello?
Oh, good. You're there.
I'm back. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Traveling through the Green Mountains of Vermont on my way back to New York City.
Okay, great. So we were talking about this conviction of yours that you have put your life on the line, as it were, in service of what you consider a very noble profession and a very noble thing to do with your profession.
Well, listen, I was a community organizer and a social worker as a young man. I lived and worked in the Winnebago, Omaha, and Santee Sioux reserves as a VISTA volunteer. I ran an anti-poverty agency and a drug program in just outside of New York City. I reached the point where I decided that I needed to become an attorney, and I spent the first 7 years in my practice for the Legal Aid Society and the Criminal Defense Division of New York City and the South Bronx, and then the rest is almost 25 years of fighting what I consider the good fight all over the world. In fact, the very week that we had a loss in Abu Ghraib, we had an enormous victory in a case that I've been co-counsel on in South Africa over a free speech case. So we get around.
How has the system retaliated against you?
Well, I know I've been monitored and surveilled and investigated for almost 15 years at various times by Homeland Security, by the FBI, that went nowhere, by the DEA, that went nowhere, and then eventually the IRS. I guess they figured my last name is Capone instead of Cohen, set off on a 5-year investigation and ended up charging me with impeding the United States tax code, whatever that means. No one really knows, and it's a case that's been pending in the Northern District for a number of years, and we will be going to trial fairly soon on that matter. It's caused enormous stress in my life and practice. It's bankrupted us, and when I say us, my family, and injured the practice. It's affected our ability to do as much pro bono work as we wanted to. I expect to be vindicated. I think it's clearly retaliatory and political in nature, very much the way my former partner, Lynn Stewart, was prosecuted for her righteous fight. It's okay. It comes with the turf. I expect it. You know, the great civil rights lawyer of 100 years ago, Clarence Darrow, once said, who himself was indicted, show me a criminal defense attorney who spends his or her life representing the despised, the despaired, and the disaffected who's never been charged himself or herself, and I'll show you someone who's failed as a defense attorney.
What is your assessment of the criminal justice system in the United States now?
Oh, I think it's among the worst in the world. We huff and puff about how egalitarian and protective and fair it is and how much it's driven by due process. We take a look at a prison. We have more people in jail than basically any other country in the world. The vast majority of them people of color. The vast majority for nonviolent offenses. Drug offenses and drug prosecutions have become enormous business for this country. This administration has been involved more with the abuse and manipulation of the Attorney General's office than any other in recent history. It's used to enforce political orthodoxy. It's used to prevent the criminals on Wall Street and the political parties from being brought to the courts of law. It seeks out whistleblowers. It seeks out and penalizes people who challenge the administration. The Obama administration makes no compunction about its willingness, its desire to instruct the Holder administration as to who to go after and who not to. There's no independence. And as I said, this administration, which came in under the mantle of being a progressive, enlightened administration, has turned out to be one of the most repressive, if not the most repressive in my lifetime, on any level, particularly when it comes to the criminal justice system, which is corrupt and bankrupt, which is filled with political hacks, with persons who have no independence and no integrity.
Well, in the African-American community, there is a legendary lawyer, Alton Maddox, who has had, in terms of retaliation, the state attorney general to direct the state legislature to basically prevent him from appearing in service of any client in a court of law in the state of New York. When the state acts like this, where do you go for help? Where would an Alton Maddox go for help?
Well, Alton has to keep fighting the fight. Alton, there are certain attorneys that reach a point even beyond the question of trying cases in courtrooms that stand so openly and proudly for the voice of justice that you move on and you move up and you move in different directions. You speak out, you organize, you empower. You serve as a lightning rod for others to come in your place. You teach. And that's what's happening with Alton, and I suspect that's what will end up happening with me. I mean, this prosecution, this persecution of me has been directed at one thing, and that's to get my law license and to silence me. Alton has been a voice of independence and liberation and freedom. We saw the same thing happen with Chokwe Lumumba, who recently died.
Mm-hmm.
Enormous loss in this country. And we've seen it with the great freedom fighters that stand in courts of law that can not only try a case as well as anyone else, but try it with dignity and in pursuit of justice, but to expose the beast for what it is. And they come after us. It's to be expected. It comes with the turf.
It's probably going to be hard for you to isolate any particular case, but I want to ask you just the same. Is there a particular case that you have litigated that stands out in your mind because of the nature of the case and because of the challenge, the unique challenge that the case posed to you?
Yeah, I think the case, and what really got me moving into the Middle East, was the case of Musa Abu Marzouk, the head of the political wing of Hamas, who was arrested in 1995, charged with certain immigration fraud, and then the Knesset, mind you, not the criminal justice system in Israel, handed down an indictment seeking his extradition for a series of suicide bombings or martyrdom operations in Israel. And we fought long and we fought hard, and it took 2 years of struggle, and we prevailed. We beat the cases here. We prevented his extradition to Israel. We arranged for him to be repatriated to Amman, Jordan, and eventually to Syria, and now to Egypt. It was an enormous victory. Of course, it predated 9/11. It was a very different world. But as a result of that, it served as an entree into the Middle East for me in a way, both learning about an area that I had loved my entire life, but really it just begun to touch the surface and open the door to so many cases, both prosecutions, but more importantly, cases where I've been sought out as counsel, where I've brought actions in international courts.
But you do have this, when you take on cases like that, you're really not just fighting against one governmental system.
Against
it would seem to be that other governments have an interest in the outcome of certain cases by virtue of their, you know, international treaties and their shared concern on this supposed war on terror. So when you're fighting a case like that, are you quite aware, I'm sure, that you're fighting on multiple levels?
Sure. You have, you know, you have your criminal defense, your classic criminal defense, witnesses, evidence, openings, closings, you know, all that sort of thing. But you also have to take into consideration in context the politics of the case. The defense of Abu Ghaith brought me to the Middle East on five occasions. It had me meeting with persons that are still considered designated terrorists and targets for assassination. It had me meeting with heads of state. It had me dealing with courts all over the world. There's a political dynamic, there's a social dynamic, there's a national liberation dynamic, there's a traditional criminal defense dynamic, and that has certainly been, fortunately for me, one of my strengths over the many years, that when I take a case that involves so-called international terrorism, I don't need to get the primer, I don't need the annotated version. I know the groups, I know the movements, I know the issues, I know the individuals. In this case, we were able to get access to Salam Hamdan, who was the driver for Osama bin Laden. We were able to get access to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's in Gitmo. We were able to meet with a dozen or more Gitmo detainees who have been repatriated or released back to their country. I was able to meet with targets of U.S. Investigations at this point. It's one of the benefits of having the political life and experience that myself and my co-counsels in this case had, that very few lawyers can begin to deal with, let alone understand.
How do you assess your profession?
Oh, I don't have a great deal of faith in my profession. I recently commented to someone, when you go into what I consider to be the most political courtrooms in the United States, which are basically criminal courts in New York City and other major cities, which are conveyor belts of young women and men, people of color being pushed in and out, charged with petty offenses, and develop rap sheets, and end up in jail with no future. I commented to someone recently while spending a morning in the Manhattan criminal court that you need a scorecard to tell the players. You couldn't tell the difference between counsel for the defense and counsel for the government. I think that, you know, we've glorified this notion of prosecution. You know, people get empowered at a very young age, lawyers, with this notion that, you know, that when they get up and they say they represent the people of the state of New York or the people of the United States, there's something wonderful and glorious about it, when in fact, those are the entities that repress us. They steal our liberties, they try to repress our activities, our thoughts, our freedoms. They go after us if we walk to a different beat. They try to maintain this homogeneous view towards who we are as individuals. And they seek to stamp out in any way, shape, or form they can people that they believe pose a threat to their stranglehold on our status.
Besides the Abu Ghraib case, what other cases are next on your agenda for litigating?
Well, I'm doing an appeal in the Eighth Circuit of a young Somali woman who was sentenced to 20 years in jail for having the audacity of raising approximately $30,000 to send to her home country in Somalia for food, for camps, because the camps are in an area controlled by Al-Shabaab, a designated foreign terrorist organization that some people consider a freedom movement. I have an appeal of a young man who I represented in Newark, New Jersey, for material support. He got 20 years basically for talk, having been trapped by an FBI agent, someone who had been thrown out of every school he went between the ages of 6 to 16, who had significant mental health issues. Like so many other young men in this country that get victimized by stings, I've been approached to represent Sheikh Ahmed Rahman, who was Lynn Stewart's former client, to see if I can get a condition change in his incarceration. We're working on building a case in the International Criminal Courts against the coup in Egypt. My every day, I've still got the anonymous case that's pending. I'm about to start the trial of Mona Atawi, a famous, and I might add, secular activist from Egypt, who's charged with criminal mischief in New York City for vandalizing a racist, anti-Islamic poster that a Zionist group put on the subway walls. So there's never a lack of cases.
Well, we'll be in touch again, Stanley. We'll talk some more about your career and about the cases that you're handling. But I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's great to reconnect with you after all these years.
It's absolute honor. When I heard you on the other end, it brought me back to years, the good fight in the old days in Harlem, and your wonderful work with the City Sun. And anytime you need someone to spend some time with you and your wonderful listeners, don't hesitate.
Thank you so much, Stanley. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Is Gary available?
Yes, I am. Hi, please.
Hello, Gary.
I'm always available. I live 24/7 at the microphone.
Well, I'm glad that you could join me because, really, the task in these last few minutes of the program is to elicit response from the listening audience. You hear the kinds of programming we do, and this is a plea for you to step forward and help PRN do the work that we want to continue doing. So, Gary, please describe what it is they're not buying it. We are thanking them for these things, for their pledges with these gifts. Please tell us what we are offering today.
Sure. Well, just so people understand, Progressive Radio Network, which is the number one internet radio program in the world, and with millions upon millions of downloads, tens of millions of downloads, none of its programs have ever been into a fund drive like NPR or PBS or Pacifica. Instead, I'm the only one up until this day, or our last week, who takes just one day a week, a little bit of time, 3 or 4 minutes, offers something that the money goes to Progressive Radio Network and also helps Utrice lead. And we're happy to do that. And Utrice has selected some premiums that she believes would enhance the well-being of the audience. So that's what it's about. Now, and we also make it really nice for the people, the gifts that we give, because we give them far more than what the value is. Now, normally it works just the opposite. It's called the 10-to-1. So if you see a book on PBS, generally it's $100, or book and DVD, $120, we do it just the opposite. We make it inexpensive, so therefore you get a huge savings. So what have we done today that would really make a difference in someone's life? Well, we all have to eat, but we're not all eating our fruits and vegetables. We need the vegetables. We need the chlorophyll. We need something that is gluten-free, that really is full spectrum in its antioxidants, nutrients. Well, we have such a thing. It is called green stuff. It is raw, all natural, delicious tasting. It's derived from fresh vegetables and whole foods. For example, there's only 60 calories, so it's great for diabetics or people wanting to watch their weight. The number one ingredients in here are cherries and pineapple, almost 10,000 milligrams or 10 grams. That's a lot. That's why it has such a rich cherry and pineapple flavor and taste. But you're getting organic barley grass, apple pectin, spinach, parsley. You're getting the carrot juice, oat beta-glucan, kale, asparagus, spirulina, the algae, chlorella, the algae, celery, onion, cauliflower, cabbage, broccoli, radishes, broccoli sprouts, collard greens. All that has been harvested, washed, pressed. The juice goes out, goes into a stainless steel cauldron, and then it's wicked off at about 88 degrees, so it's a real living food. It's a powder, but it's a living food. It hasn't been scorched. It hasn't been high heat. The antioxidants are rich, the phytonutrients, the chlorophyll. All the chemicals that are in any given food are here. Now, here's a question. We all know that we have to have fruits and vegetables. We all know that we're not eating enough. Every study shows that we're not getting what we need, and that's the building blocks of our cells, the enzymes. We need this into our cells. So I invented this about 25 years ago and put it into a jar so that it's convenient. You wake up in the morning, you take a scoop of green stuff, you throw it into a blender, and put in your favorite liquid, apple juice, tomato juice, grapefruit juice, orange juice, whatever it is, rice milk, soy milk, and then anything else you want to add in is fine as well. But this at least gives you the idea that you're getting something good that your body can benefit from right into every serving of green stuff. It's raw, all natural, 20 vegetables and phytonutrients. That you're getting the organic kale, which is a superstar, the organic barley grass, which is a superstar, the spirulina, chlorella, the broccoli sprouts. These are superstars. Apple pectin, a superstar. So we're giving you the best possible greens, plus a few fruits, the pineapple and cherry, that all blended together. It's gluten-free, it's Circle K kosher, it's vegan, and it comes from nature. So this is one good thing you can do each day, because I'm willing to bet that most people in this audience have very active lifestyles and would like to do the right thing with their diet, but don't always have a chance. This is one way you don't have any excuses. Do the right thing for your body. So that's what you're getting. You're getting green stuff. But we're going to give you two DVDs, not one, but two, as our gifts. One is Preparing Live Food. And this is with myself and Roberta Addy, a famous chef. Roberta was on Armand's show for 20 years on BAI, answering the health questions. You get to see how you work with organic foods and sprouts and seeds, making them into delicious dishes. So it's a wonderful program. But then also shopping and cooking with good health with myself and my daughter, Shelley. First, because people don't know what to buy when they go into a store. And so I take you step by step of what to buy that is more nutritious and less expensive than the normal item. And then my daughter shows you how to make different dishes, all kinds of wonderful dishes, salad, soups, sandwiches, entrees, desserts, all wonderful to lower your cholesterol, to help prevent disease, to detoxify your body, to aid digestion, to purify your blood. These are the things that we do with our food. But knowing how to buy food and how to prepare food and how to juice, it's all in here. Live foods, preparing live foods is one, because everyone's into raw foods today. But separately is shopping and cooking for good health, and that is the second. So you're getting two documentaries and your green stuff, and you're saving also on the cost of all this. You're getting it below what you would buy it for otherwise. So call this number, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And ask for the premium that Utrice Lead had on her program, the green stuff premium, the new and improved green stuff. By the way, it also has what's called ORAC, which is a high antioxidant value of over 10,000 units. The average American, I'm guesstimating, gets around 600 ORAC in a day. You're getting 10,000 antioxidant ORAC in a single serving. So there's nothing to compare with this.
So I'm asking the listening audience to please support PRN.FM. We look to each other every day now to basically gather our thoughts together and share our thoughts. So I'm asking, make a pledge, if you can, of $60. And when you call 877-627-5065,
and
saving $100. You are calling in behalf of Lead Stories.
Yes, and you're saving $100 when you do. So this is an enormous discount off its regular retail price. You're only supporting the station with a gift of $60. You're getting all this, and it's shipped out today. So that's how fast you get it. No delay. Out goes today. You get your green stuff and your two documentaries in a few days, and you support Utrice Lead. You support Progressive Radio Network, and that's what we're hoping you do. Call 877-627-5065 for the green stuff. Have a nice day, everyone.
Thank you, Gary. Again, 877-627-5065. And when you call, say you're calling for Utrecia's package. That's the pledge that you're making today. Thank you so much. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Mike Fader with Occupied Territory America. And certainly you can drop me a line at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrecia Lead. Again, 877-627-5065. Come along with me and let me know you're part of the team. I want Lead Stories to look fantastic against everybody else. We do our share to keep things going. Thank you so much for joining me today.